This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a couple of issues from my comic book collection, which I will more or less select at random. Any books in my collection are eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents, or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 170th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at 6 from Sirius, 1 and 2 from Epic Comics, cover dated July and August, 1984. But first, a little feedback. And the first bit of feedback is from me. More of a follow-up than feedback, but you know what I mean. And shortly after last episode came out, I listened to episode 700 of Deconstructing Comics, where the hosts talked about the graphic novel memoir of Stan Lee, Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible. I've played a promo recently for that special series that Tim and the Deconstructing Comics team are doing of going through every Stan Lee biography and memoir that they can find and or that they can stand. And that episode, that discussion, was part of that occasional series within Deconstructing Comics. And in that book, Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible, there is evidently a page or two devoted to Atlas Comics in the 1970s. And as the hosts said, the version of the story that Stan tells is a little different from the ones told in different biographies and different histories. And seeing as I didn't know any of that at the time when I was recording those episodes, I didn't include any of it. But according to Larry Lieber, he had permission from his brother Stan to join Martin Goodman and Atlas, or at least at an absolute minimum, he had checked with Stan about how he felt about that. There seems to be no doubt that the two of them discussed it beforehand to some extent. And then after the fact, Lieber felt slighted, insulted by Stan for pretty much writing him out of Marvel from that point forward, treating him like a betrayer, someone who'd abandoned Stan. But Stan knew what was going on and what the issues were within the comics industry, why folks maybe wanted to leave and start something new. But in Stan's memoir, although he does hype Larry as an unsung hero of Marvel's early days, maybe a way to try to rebuild a bridge? I don't know. He professed not knowing why Larry left, and also not knowing why anybody left. Ditko, Kirby, whoever. Very strange, but this is my opinion, not from the book or from the Deconstructing Comics podcast. But I wonder if that, whitewashing of the story is just reflective of Stan's practice of never saying anything public that made Marvel look bad, and certainly never saying anything that made Stan look bad. But I was glad that I heard that information right around the same time as that episode came out. Okay, let's move on to feedback from, listeners. You people. Podcasting's Michael Bailey commented on both the issue and the content warning. Professor Allen, I enjoyed your coverage of this issue immensely. I think you handled the contextualization the best you could, and looking at the comic from that era it came from was the best way to go. It is weird looking back on the culture of the 70s, especially when it came to how the police were portrayed in popular media. The cop on the edge, breaking the rules, doing things his way, trope, was done to death, and with varying degrees of success. The fact that the trope continued well into the 80s and 90s speaks to the audience reacting to it. I guess after the end of the 60s and Watergate and the Vietnam War, the culture wasn't trusting its institutions anymore. But after several decades of being told to do just that, you're going to get the type of stories that appeared in this issue. It all makes sense, and a healthy distrust of institutions is usually a good idea. Based on the two stories you discussed, I would have to say the second story sounded like it had more legs in terms of becoming an ongoing series. Yeah, the dead wife slash girlfriend motif was common and has grown tiresome and a little insulting. But it is what it is, and it fits into the culture of 1975 just fine. I like the idea that this cop had to become a PI to find the men responsible for the bank heist. Though I think I'd be mad at the police sniper, but that's just me. If these were television pilots, Luke Malone Manhunter seems to be better than Lomax as a character and a concept. Great episode as always. I look forward to the next one. All the best. Podcasting's Michael Bailey. Cards on the table. When Michael and I chat about the real world, we don't always agree. Except that we agree to be respectful of each other and of each other's insane, wacky, nonsensical viewpoints. But Mike, your sentence, and a healthy distrust of institutions is usually a good idea, could have come directly from my keyboard. Matter of fact, I might very well have that sentence permanently saved to my clipboard as often as I type it. Government, military, big business, my business, the academy, the church, the police, the judiciary, the media. If it's an institution, it's worthy of, at a minimum, examination, if not outright distrust. And also, yeah, that sniper in the second story, he's the guy who needs to be investigated. But I agree that that was the story and character setup that probably had more legs as an ongoing, more opportunities to develop interesting stories. And we heard from Sir Martin from the wonderful comic review blog Too Dangerous for a Girl. Thanks for another fun show. This comic sounds interesting in a lady cop way. That is the perfect way to say it, Mart. The similarity between the two stories reminds me of a 70s DC comic in which both lead and backup strips ended on a cliffhanger of the star disappearing, and the editor instigated a contest inviting people to find a way to connect the tales. Thanks to Scott Rowland of the Back Issue Facebook group, I figured that it was Adventure Comics 457, in that Eclipso and Superboy were both fading away at the end of their separate stories. Mart then opined that maybe we probably didn't need the trigger warning, but maybe that's a comment on our perspective countries and cultures and societies as much as anything else. During Professor Frenzy, episode 153, Chris said that he liked the way I framed the content on that issue, and just that generally speaking, covering an Atlas book from his youth brought a smile to his face. Thank you, Chris. Trevor Owen Williams reported that in Facebook, they put related discussions next to certain posts. For this one, it's a news story about a man being swallowed by a humpback whale. I listen to every one of your podcasts anyway, but if it's related to that, I really have to listen. Sadly, Trevor, as you've certainly learned since then, that episode was not, in fact, related to anyone being eaten by a humpback whale. Darn you, Zuckerberg! Jason in Hawaii retweeted that link, saying that the episode was a great way to start the week. Thank you, Jason, and mahalo. And Sir Luke, a.k.a. the voice of Lomax NYPD, wrote in as well. Professor, just listen to your coverage of Police Action 2 and wanted to give some thoughts. And no, not just because I got to lean in to my on-the-edge reputation by voicing the character of Lomax. Atlas Seaboard was before my time, both as a comics reader as well as, me being a person on this earth. I found the line quite by accident. I happened across Weird Suspense number 1 featuring the tarantula in a 33-cent bin during my LCS Borderlands, always creatively named, big annual sale. I assumed that this Atlas Comics was along the lines of Eclipse, First, Now, Comico et al., a defunct indie publisher with whom I was not familiar. And with a title like Weird Suspense, they were going to get my 33 cents. It was only after reading the issue, including the copious amounts of back matter and house ads, that my eyes were opened to the short but inane history of Atlas Seaboard. You mentioned that the line is very collectible due to the relatively few number of comics published. I have undertaken that challenge. I will confess here that I knew that Luke had already undertaken this challenge when I mentioned that last episode. Luke says he currently has 20 of the 61 color comics published by Atlas Seaboard. While none are common, I suspect that some of them will be harder to find than others. I also have a single black and white magazine, Thrilling Adventure Stories, of the 11 that they published before they closed. The magazines, those are hard to come by. Consider how difficult it is to find some black and white comic mags from Marvel from this period, and then lower the print runs accordingly. Regarding Police Action, specifically, this was one of the titles I was immediately attracted to when I learned of the line. Genre books always catch my eye at this point, and while the war and Western offerings were appealing, I had never delved much into police or crime comics, so I was intrigued by the title. The format of having each issue contain two features of equal length, that also piqued my curiosity. The juxtaposition of the more brightly colored Lomax strips by Mike Sikowski with the darker, moodier Luke Malone by Mike Plug made for a great anthology package. For the price of admission, you get both sides of the coin. The tough guy, cowboy cop, and the grimy, gritty private eye. I have to mention the scene in the lead story in issue 2, where at the end of the ordeal, Lomax actually threatens the two male hostages for not doing more to save themselves or save the woman. The scene is completely astounding in just how outdated it is. But it is part of the charm of these books, and the Lomax strips in particular. Thanks, and as always, looking forward to whatever cheap comics come down the pipe, Sir Luke of the Upstate. Of course, Luke, and thank you again for your vocal contributions to last episode. Social media love for last episode came from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Chris Willett, Vic in Phoenix, Clinton, from Coffee and Comics, Manuel Carmona, from Buy Indie Comics Day, both Billy D. and Herman from Into the Weird, Dr. Ange, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Karen from Between the Pages, James from Karen, Laurel Mountain Flower One from the Hunters Podcast, Old School Ross, Bill Beer from the Bat Pod, Dark Mark 1984, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Chuck Daddy 64, Chris, from the aforementioned Professor Frenzy, which is a show, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Randy Watts, and our listeners of the year, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. Time to take a little break for a promo, and when we come back, we'll be getting our sci-fi.
Hey, you. Yeah, you listening to this. My name is Mercy St. Clair, and I'm a trekker. Not a very glamorous job, but not according to some group called the Occadecanagon Theater Works.
And me. I think your adventures can be very glamorous.
Oh, come off it, Molly. What I do is dirty, dangerous, and frustrating.
Maybe. But I know I like hearing about what you do, and now other people can as well.
That's where you come in. Yes, you. The one I started talking to before being interrupted. Head on over to 8tw.ninja and look for my adventures as dramatized by the Occadecanagon Theater Works and some guy named Ron Randall. Or else.
Mercy!
Ron Randall's Trekker, a new audio drama by the Occadecanagon Theater Works, presented through the Two True Freaks Podcast Network. Coming summer 2021.
And we're back. Both Six from Sirius 1 and 2 had cover prices of $1.50, meaning I got these at a discount of... Well, there's a bit of a story to tell about that. The first source I ever had for quarter books were the quarterly quarter bin sales at the late lamented In the Ballpark store. Every 3 months, they'd dig out what must have been 25 to 30 long boxes of cheap books, price them at a quarter each, and I would spend at least one long afternoon going through them all. Now, I didn't know Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit at that time, but I am sure that we cross paths in our cheapskate bin diving adventures. And one day, I found this miniseries. So, you'd think I'd pick them up for a buck total, right? 25-cent sale, four comics, that multiplies to one cool dollar. Except, these issues were all together in one single magazine-sized bag.
Or Golden Age-sized bag.
So they would all fit in there. Let me emphasize, I did not put them all in one bag. They were already in one single, slightly oversized bag. Now, I wasn't going to buy these either way, but the owner, after flipping through what I have and taking a quick look at that bag, counted that as one book. So it was a quarter for all four books total. Yes, Stella, even with taxes, that's right around 7 cents per issue. Boom! Meaning I got these books at a discount of nearly 96%. Now, I don't want to put any undue pressure on Six from Sirius, but this has potential to be one of the best deals ever. So let's get right to these. Both of these issues featured covers by Paul Galassi. The cover of issue one shows a purpley dark space background with the head and shoulders of an astronaut wearing a traditional space helmet, and reflected off the faceplate, we see five beings, and along with the person in the suit, it is safe to assume that these are the Six from Sirius. Now, sci-fi covers, whether on prose novels or anthology magazines, they really are a particular category or style of art. They tend to be distinctive in a way from other novels or magazines. And this cover definitely fits that category, I think. It's distinctive, it's different, it's bold, and it's definitely sci-fi. I like it. It really sets a tone. The story, Phase One, Phaedra, was written by Doug Mensch with art by Paul Galassi. Mensch and Galassi are also credited as co-creators, and they are the creative team for all four issues of the mini. Issue one starts with a beautiful woman who appears to be deep in thought, possibly meditating. Somewhere in a strange land, a mind conceives.
we transition into the scene that she is singing, which is a poker game on a starship. In quick order, we meet the two ladies on the squad, Zemetin and Lamask. Poker players are Screed, the bearded redhead, and Starn, the black fella. There's also a green guy, Grodd, and the leader is Jacasa Lone. All of these folks are humanoid, two arms, two legs, one head, all of that. The green guy is the only obvious non-earthling. Jacasa, the leader, calls the team together, announcing that they have just received their assignment orders from Sirius Hub. And if you are keeping track, you know that we have six members of the Sirius team, the Sirius Six. Phase one is a killer all by itself, so I won't even trouble you with the rest until the time comes. We see on the video screen a picture of the pretty lady from the first page. Her name is Phaedra, from the planet Balsamo, and she's the ambassador to a moon called Heavenstone, which orbits the planet Axelon. We learn that she has Class A ESP powers, the highest rating of any mind ever tested. Phaedra is currently in Roundwall, a deep space prison station built by Balsamo, which raises the question of why she has been incarcerated by her own people. And from all available intelligence, one of the most impregnable structures ever designed. The prison is manned by functional facsimiles of men, known as Faxmen. So we have our team's mission, break the ESP ambassador lady out of her space prison. And they come up with a plan. They disguise their ship within an asteroid shower and sneak their way onto the prison satellite. Fighting their way through a horde of Faxmen, each utilizes their own separate skills, and the six find their way to the wing where the ambassador is being held. This is another spot where the plan hits a speed bump. Phaedra does not want to be rescued. According to her people, she's not being imprisoned there. She's being protected there. No doubt from brigands such as you. Also, she recognizes Jacasa from her visions. They now have linked minds. But the team follows their orders and rescues the ambassador anyway, by releasing all of the prisoners on the satellite and skedaddling off with her in the confusion. On the last page, back on the Sirius ship, Phaedra continues to be not pleased. You pompous asses think you rule all of known space. If you think you can blackmail Balsamo into joining your vile federation by holding me hostage. After a little more political back and forth, Zemetin explains. Your rescue, Ambassador, was phase one of our attempt to prevent Heavenstone from being blasted to a cinder, quite possibly by Balsamo itself. The ambassador claims that that's a lie, that Sirius is full of nothing but heathen liars. Captain Jacasa tells her that diplomacy is alive and well, and something tells me, Ambassador Phaedra, that you and I are going to make superb allies. End of phase one. Which leads directly into phase two, Master Fax. As we said before, all of the creator credits are the same, and I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but all four covers say Six from Sirius by Doug Mensch and Paul Gulacy. So both creators' full names are there on the covers, and I think that is worth a mention. The cover of issue two shows our six leads, and a few aliens as well, all in different colors against a black background. Again, it's very good, different from most comics, again, closer to some of the imagery that you might see on a classic Golden Age sci-fi novel. Phase two starts aboard the Sirius Six, which seems to be the name of the ship, as well as the name of the team, I may have missed that during the first issue. Anyway, now we have seven folk aboard the Sirius Six as our team and the ambassador begin to start to almost think about trusting each other. One of the six, Zematine, is blessed with a solenoid soul, giving her an affinity with machines that ranks as almost a sixth sense. She is running a matter converter, which the ambassador does not believe such a thing only exists in fantasy. One of the advantages of joining Sirius Swarm, they tell her, is access to such machinery. A man materializes, a curly-haired fellow with a solid beard. He is Collator Jaquendor, and he briefs the team on the next phase of their assignment. And let's just say, this is one heck of a PowerPoint slide deck. Axelon used to be the supreme power of its solar system, but Balsamo, the ambassador's world, has advanced at a stunning rate, challenging, perhaps surpassing, Axelon. And now both planets seem to be itching for war, point that the ambassador disputes. The third wheel in this unfortunate triangle is the moon, Heavenstone, recently colonized by a group of religious fanatics, spiritualists, led by the Five Elders. After being systematically persecuted by Axelon's planetary government, they request exodus to the moon once it could be made habitable. Eager to be rid of the non-productive spiritualists, Axelon gave permission. But to their surprise, the moon has not only been rendered habitable, it was sculptured into a paradise and given its current name of Heavenstone. The source of the funding behind this new world's lavish creation is unknown, but Axelon points the finger of accusation at Balsamo. Suspicions apparently confirmed when Balsamo parbeam weapons were installed on Heavenstone, with full complicity of the new spiritualist residents of the moon. And that is where we are now. Axelon wants its moon back. They say for defense reasons, but Balsamo says it's so they can keep persecuting their religious minority. The six agents from Sirius Hub are dispatched to forestall the simmering conflict by attending the scheduled peace negotiations on Heavenstone. As the Collator wraps up his TED Talk and heads back via the matter converter, the machine explodes because another being was beaming in at the same time. It's one of the Faxmen from Balsamo. It's the leader. It's Master Fax, relentless assassin. And his orders are to kill Phaedra. That's right, his own ambassador. She realizes now that she was not, in fact, being held for her safety, but was actually being imprisoned. Phaedra uses her ESP powers to somehow keep Captain Jacasa Lane safe from Master Fax's attack. And after running around the ship for a while, the six, now seven, find a pod and flee the ship. But there's only one way to keep Master Fax from following them to the negotiations. Cancel the ship's defense shields from here. And destroy it. Problem is that after kidnapping the ambassador and the death of the Collator on their ship during that matter-trans-matter accident, then destroying their ship, they don't really have a safe place to flee to now. Both the Axelons and the Balsamoites are probably equal in their distrust. But on Axelon, they might have friends. The Five Elders who founded the Heavenstone movement. We learn here that Phaedra foresaw the Collator's death with her Esper powers, and she was able to save the captain. When I saw you in danger in my mind, something happened. Cue the love theme. On Balsamo, we see a perfect Faxwoman duplicate of Phaedra, being examined. She is declared ready for service. Meanwhile, Phaedra uses her powers to guide the small escape pod past the Axelon planetary defenses, and they land in a remote desert. Inside a deep cave, they find, after battling giant dragon things and a range of monsters, they find the skeletons of the five elders sitting around a round table. And as soon as they enter, energy manifests as light. And the light is glorious. And the glory inspires awe. "It's alive," Lamask says, examining her sort of tricorder thing. "But it's also not alive. It's beyond life." Phaedra makes telepathic contact with the collective life essence of the five elders who were slain by the Axelon military. And their goal was simple: life, peace, connection. We learn here that Phaedra once considered joining in the exodus to Heavenstone. "But in the end, I was too pragmatic, too afraid. I do still feel an affinity, a sympathy with their movement." Power reaches out to Phaedra, and the elders elevate her to a communing. Now remember, when we said that they exploded the ship and they killed the Masterfax robot assassin? Well, that Masterfax just keeps coming for him. He arrives in the cave, set on destruction, but the green guy, he's Grodd, kills him with a single blast, which doesn't make any sense, everyone quickly realizes. Seeing as Masterfax survived a spaceship exploding and then the cold vacuum of space itself, how could one little blast have killed him? Well, it turns out that the five elders, channeling through Phaedra, helped the blast kill the robot. And they actually accept, the elders, accept the tiny spark of life within Masterfax. And he joins them in peace. The spirits leave the skeletons, leaving the Sirius Six plus one, alone in the cave. And on the last page of this issue, Jocasa alone decides the team's next step, knowing he must keep Phaedra alive until the scheduled peace negotiations to ensure her presence there. They are heading to the moon, to Heavenstone, to await further developments. The end. So, as our buddy Trentus Magnus used to ask, what did I think of this? Well, as I've said many times on many podcasts, I'm a huge fan of sci-fi stories, both in prose and in comic books. And if you look back over the history of the Quarterbin podcast, you'll see that sci-fi stories may be overrepresented compared to their comic book sales. By my counts, we've done 5 episodes starring Adam Strange, 4 with the Micronauts, and 2 with Rom. And then we've done Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Time Warp, Lost Universe, iBots, Shatter, Mars, Battlestar Galactica, and with this episode and next, 6 from Sirius. There are a couple of subcategories within sci-fi: hard sci-fi, near future sci-fi, alternate history, cyberpunk, steampunk, among many others. This story fits firmly into the subgenre of space opera. The website Sci-Fi Ideas defines space opera stories as usually set in space or involving travel between two or more planets, with a large number of recurring characters and a focus on large-scale or epic fictional events such as galactic wars. Recurring themes in space opera include politics, imperialism, colonialism, war, space exploration, heroism, and rebellion. And so far, through 2 issues, 6 from Sirius checks a lot of those boxes. And that's exactly what this is. Big scale, big stakes, big circumstances. And that's what I liked about this. It could easily be a prose novel. There is so much going on. And for me, by the way, that's a compliment. On the other hand, there's a lot going on here. These are standard size comic books, 32 pages. And there are no outside ads in either of these. So it was 32 and 29 pages of story, respectively. But even with those extra pages over the standard, now 20 or 22 pages you'd get in an issue, there's a lot going on here. Whatever the opposite of decompressed is, that's exactly what these are. They take a while to read, and for me that's usually a good thing, especially when it's a sci-fi type of story. The drawback, of course, is, and this will definitely turn off a fair number of readers, there are a lot of words in this, and there's a lot of narrative exposition. Mensch and Galassi do their best to make each one of those bits exciting, dramatic, artistically appealing, but there's a lot of just people talking, just explaining stuff. Now, we do have to talk about the art before we get going too far, though, because this is not just a Doug Mensch series. This is, as the covers say, by Doug Mensch and Paul Galassi. That is, of course, the legendary team from their legendary run on Master of Kung Fu in the 70s. They did something like 30-plus issues together, after which Galassi left comics almost completely to work in commercial illustration. He did magazine layouts, art for advertisements, storyboards for TV commercials, that sort of thing. Now, one of the strengths of the work here is Galassi's panel layout, letting the size of the panels do some of the work of pacing for the story. Now, according to a page in the second issue, Six from Sirius took more than 2 years to produce as Galassi worked on it between other jobs. And the work itself, the detail required, was quite painstaking. I will quote a sentence from that about page, because it describes the nature of the art far better than I could ever do. The final work is a result of an arcane and complex process of experimentation utilizing a variety of mediums, including acrylics, markers, colored inks, and pencils. In terms of the physical construction of the books, the paper is better than newsprint, but it lacks the glossy sheen of the type of comic book paper that would arrive during, say, the 90s, which gives these issues actually a serious advantage over those later works, because the coloring is not overwhelming. It's not painful to look at. It does not assault the senses. It just works and continues to work 35 years later. It works very, very well. Now, back to the story. One of the drawbacks, one bit that actually made me laugh, at first not in a good way, but I sort of figured out maybe it's a reference, a purposeful joke, so I've gotten over it since then. And that's the name of our lead character, the captain of the Sirius Six, Jacasa Lone. L-O-N-E. Lone. Because he has no family, no friends, just whatever team he's on as he rogues his way through space on his own. Solo, one might even say. But actually, I like Han. I like Jacasa. I imagine there's a romantic spark between he and Phaedra that will be addressed next time in the back half of the series. Oh, one very weird thing about this, and it's not really touched on in the information pages on the inside front cover of issue one, but there are enough clues here that I could think, I can maybe guess what happened. And this is being presented to us in four issues as four phases of the story. They don't call them chapters, which I think is a little precious, but I'll let it slide because I like the story enough. But the first phase comes up a little short for issue one, mean, actually, I guess it's perfect comic book length. It's 22 pages. But like I said, issue one had no ads in it. So it's 32 pages. So we get a dramatic cliffhanger and a box that reads end of phase one. And then on the opposite page starts the first 10 pages of phase two. Now, when I did the synopses above, I covered the phases separately, pretending that issue one only had phase one and issue two was only phase two, which is actually how issues three and four do play out. The phases and the issues do sync up at that point. But there was something weird happening with issue one. And I think that's probably tied into the history of the series, in which Mensch and Galassi, they were not sure how this story would eventually be presented. This was Epic's first miniseries, or as editor Archie Goodwin called it, a super graphic novel, if you will, and we'll get back to that. This was originally planned to run an Epic Illustrated, probably as 8 to 10 page installments, over an undetermined number of issues. And it seemed like, I wonder if those first few pages, maybe that first phase was already scripted out, perhaps even laid out, perhaps some finished art. Because by the time they were making progress on the art, the plan seemed to have changed. The Epic Comics line had changed, and it was decided that this would be presented as a 4-issue limited series, which again was not the way it was originally envisioned, at least by Mensch. So I imagine it's changes like that that led to issue one not just including phase one, but also a chunk of phase two, that there was some question about the total number of pages they'd have to tell this story, total number of issues that those pages would be broken up into. So there seems to have been some discrepancy, perhaps, between what Mensch envisioned as the nature of the physical storytelling versus what they actually ended up with. But back to the comics themselves, to the story. I said that I liked the big scope, the war between planets, political intrigue, all that sort of stuff works for me. But there are certainly some weaknesses in these issues. First, the six from Sirius themselves, the characters. We had nearly 60 pages. That should be plenty of space to develop these characters. But that really wasn't done all that much, other than the leader and his burgeoning love interest with Ambassador Phaedra. I don't have much of a feel for the other five, their personalities, their priorities, their backgrounds. I really can't differentiate one from the other. So this is a much more bland crew than we get on good sci-fi TV. Just think of the characters on Babylon 5, Farscape, most Star Trek iterations, Firefly. You have particular, specific, very differentiated characters. You know who each one is. Even the better sci-fi comic books usually deliver this. Certainly, after 60 pages of story. And again, maybe this other issue I have is also a matter of how the story was formatted. But I still think it could have been worked around. It could have been avoided. And that is that the cliffhanger at the end of the second issue is just nothing. Despite the fact that the team is trying to stop a planetary war, which is pretty dramatic, and they've had some pretty dramatic experiences with these mystical, spiritualist, dead, not quite dead elders. But you have to admit, the actual ending, it's literally, let's go to the moon and wait there and see what might possibly happen when things get started for the peace talks in a few days. It's, what? That is such a weird choice. What a weird way to end an issue, to end a phase of the story. And I do think fundamentally, this is one of the situations that brings up the debate of, quote, comic book or comic book collection versus, quote, graphic novel. If you're reading this all as one collection, as one continued story, you just turn the page and roll on to issue 3. No big deal if there's not a dramatic drive at the end of that chapter or not, a cliffhanger of sorts at the end of the issue, because there's not a built-in waiting period in that type of situation, you know, for the reader. The creators don't have to depend on reader anticipation to maintain for a month. You just turn the page and move on. But often in comic books, the story is broken up into discrete elements. And I do think you need to try to figure out how to end each one of those discrete elements, whether it's 22 pages, 28 pages, 30 pages. You should try to end that with a dramatic punch, with enough to bring the reader back in a month. And I think partly this is where I think, like definitionally, you can argue that a trade collection is different from a graphic novel. And I think there's more to it than whether it comes out in single issues, because that's a marketing decision, not a creative one. And it seems, from what I can read into the history of Six from Sirius, as well as just physically the way the book works, Mensch and Galassi created one type of story, and Marvel cut it up into different ways to market it, at least in its original floppy form. And that manner of issue release changed during the time the story was being developed. Now, I think that's only part of the equation in terms of if the story comes out in issues, then it's a collection, not a graphic novel. I think that is fair enough a lot of the time, but I think clearly here these issues were not the way that the story was intended to be consumed by the reader. So I think you have to take into account the nature of the story itself, and fundamentally how the creators, probably the writer in particular in this case, how they envision the work, how they consider the work. So even though I'm reading these issue by issue, even though the entire premise of the Quarter Bin podcast is to judge comics issue by issue, I'm more comfortable thinking about Six from Sirius as a graphic novel. Let the fighting commence. But the big question is, at this point of this episode, how is all of that going to affect my verdict? The verdict on Six from Sirius 1 and 2? Well, based on what I just said above, honestly, it's sort of an incomplete. I don't rate a 410-page novel on Goodreads after I've only read the first 205. And I kind of feel strange doing the equivalent of that here. But I will attempt to fulfill the contract that I've made with you, lovely listener. And I will, in fact, under protest, mind you, issue verdicts on these two issues. The main thing is that these issues contain 32 and 29 pages of space opera adventure, respectively. And the fact is, I only paid about 7 cents each. So on that measure alone, these are absolute bargains. But, again, the deal here is whether they're worth 25 cents, which I must point out again, I did not pay. Now, the characters are a little bland, and issue 2 ended on a weak point. But the general story intrigues me, the worlds are interesting, and the two leads spark my interest, the captain and the ambassador. And this is something I don't often say, but the quality of the art really clinches the deal for me, because these are lovely books to look at. And that means that these are totally quarter bin deals. And that wraps up our coverage of Six from Sirius 1 and 2, bringing episode 170 to a close. Next time, we're just going to stay on this train. Sorry, I mean, we're going to stay on this intergalactic space pod and wrap up the series, or finish reading the graphic novel by covering 6 from Sirius 3 and 4. Cover dated September and October 1984. If you have any questions or comments about these issues or the episode, sci-fi comics, space opera, or anything about the epic line, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.